Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Monday, May 16th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Clara Germani.
And I'm Ken Kaplan.
Of the five mass shootings that jolted the U.S. this weekend, the one that speaks most ominously about America at the moment was in Buffalo. There, at a supermarket, a white male 18-year-old allegedly shot 13 people, 11 of them black. His online writings reportedly suggest replacement theory was a reason for killing black people. The theory holds that there is a conspiracy to replace white people with people of color across the American socioeconomic landscape. It has been cited as inspiration for a number of hate crimes. That hate is a distorted form of a wider, quieter fear that a significant share of Americans apparently hold. A May 9th AP NORC poll found 32% of American adults believe that some people are trying to replace native-born Americans with immigrants for electoral gains. About the same amount expressed concern that an increase in immigration is leading to native-born Americans losing economic, political, and cultural influence. These beliefs are at the root of replacement theory. The Buffalo shooting is an atrocity. The wider fear behind it demands patient deconstructing. Yasha Monk, the political philosopher and founder of the online publication Persuasion, says the idea that America will be a majority-minority nation by 2045 is dangerously leveraged as triumphalism on the left and panic on the right. Monk says, the left is saying these rising groups will dominate politics and culture and all of the problems of America will be solved. On the right, they're thinking it's going to eclipse us and we're never going to win. The real world is more complicated than that. Even within the same race, the diversity of thought and identity is enormous. As Mr. Monk concludes, when you're talking about the majority-minority America, a lot of this is going to be mixed-race Americans or Hispanics, many of whom actually in key ways think of themselves as white, or people who are going to have spouses or other close relatives who are white. And so this idea that you can understand American society as these two monolithic blocks of whites and people of color, and that's the fundamental dividing line in America, thankfully, is not true. Now, today's stories. Our first story. It may seem like a paradox, but many of the women who turned out for the abortion rights protests this past weekend were beyond their childbearing years. One distinction, they often have memories of a pre-Roe America.
The thousands of people who rallied for abortion rights in Washington Saturday were a diverse group in many ways, including gender, age, and race. But perhaps most striking was the large number of women of a certain age, those in their 50s and beyond. Women no longer in their childbearing years, but who felt so passionately about the possible demise of the Supreme Court's landmark Roe v. Wade ruling that they had to do something public. For older American women, the memories of pre-Roe days can be visceral. The illegal and sometimes dangerous abortions they or their friends had, the women who died from a botched abortion, the sadness and shame of giving birth as a teenager, then in some cases placing the baby for adoption, the fight to make abortion legal nationwide. It's not that younger women don't care about the issue. In fact, many polls show younger women are generally more supportive of abortion rights than older women. Younger people didn't grow up in a non-Roe world, says Jennifer Butler, a 50-something Presbyterian minister and outgoing CEO of the advocacy group Faith in Public Life. They've always taken that right pretty much for granted. This story was reported by Linda Feldman in Washington and Henry Gass in Austin, Texas, for the Monitor.
An unusual primary battle between the sitting Idaho governor and his lieutenant reflects national divisions within the Republican Party over conservatism and extremism and, once again, Donald Trump.
Idaho's Republican governor and lieutenant governor, who square off against each other in Tuesday's gubernatorial primary, have been publicly feuding for more than 2 years. In the early weeks of the pandemic, Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan drew national attention for her opposition to Governor Brad Little's stay-at-home order. Twice, when Mr. Little was out of town, she issued her own executive orders banning masks and vaccine mandates. Twice, he rescinded them. Ms. McGeehan has also pressed for a 50-state audit of the 2020 election. Last November, former President Donald Trump endorsed her, calling her a true supporter of MAGA. Idaho's unique brand of Western conservatism has been undergoing something of an identity crisis as it grapples with Trump-inspired populism and absorbs a steep influx of new residents. If the first-term governor beats his lieutenant, as limited polling predicts he will, it could signal a growing resistance to a further right pull in a deep red state long known for an extremist streak. Nationally, we're going through a political realignment, says Marky McBrayer, assistant professor of political science at the University of Idaho. It's no real surprise that we're seeing similar sort of factions occur at the state level. The story was reported by Sarah Matusik in Boise, Idaho, for The Monitor.
Russia's war in Ukraine isn't just on the battlefield, it's online too. But experts have been surprised that Russia's disinformation strategies are as unsophisticated as their real-life ones.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine has been accompanied by a high-volume, multilingual disinformation campaign that has jolted fact-checking experts in Ukraine and the West into action. But experts have been surprised at just how unsophisticated that campaign has been. They say Russia has been taking the same approach to deploying fakes as it does to soldiers on the battlefield, large numbers but with poor ammunition. The strongest side of Russian disinformation is not the quality, but continuation and repetition, says Ukrainian fact-checker Oksana Ilyuk. They do not care about each fake being sophisticated and deliberate, they just want to flood the information space. It's actually been surprising how bad Russian disinformation has been, said Elliot Higgins, founder of the investigative journalism group Bellingcat, at a Chatham House event. I mean, we've had years of disinformation from Syria and Ukraine being debunked and kind of thought we would see Russia upping its game. Russia's disinformation has not improved. It's almost as if they swapped the words Syria with Ukraine and jihadists with Nazis in many cases. It's almost absurd, but it's still very important to address that information. This story was reported by Dominique Sogel in Kyiv, Ukraine, for The Monitor.
Our progress roundup includes a look at innocence. Unfortunately, not being at fault doesn't guarantee justice. But a national record of exonerations is one step toward avoiding wrongful convictions in the U.S. In the UK, not needing to declare fault in petitions to divorce is allowing for more harmonious proceedings. You can read up on all of this week's points of progress by Erica Page in today's issue. Now, commentary from the Monitor's editorial board on this weekend's mass shooting in Buffalo. Mass tragedies often bring a community closer together, as Buffalo, New York discovered May 14th after the killing of 10 people at a neighborhood store. Crowds gathered in prayer vigils near the Tops Friendly Market. Muslim and Jewish leaders gave support to the Black community, the target of a young white man's violent, racist rage. Those affected were offered free meals along with free grief counseling. You can see how vibrant our community is, said local activist Terrell Ford, inciting the acts of kindness aimed at helping people transcend the crisis. Yet, amid the trauma and the calls for action against online hate and gun access, some leaders in Buffalo viewed the public's response as the start of a better, stronger community. We will not be defined by this incident, said Mark Pollenkars, executive for Erie County, which includes Buffalo. The city, he added, can be defined by how we recover. That lesson fits the responses in many other places struck by mass killing and that have sought renewal alongside resilience. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. For more Monitor audio, including our serial podcasts, go to csmonitor.com/podcasts. Thanks for starting your week with us. Come back tomorrow for a look at debates within China's Communist Party and some recommendations for your next read. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor writes that when hate crimes or other animosity-fueled tragedies occur, it may seem that hatred is more powerful than love. But have you ever thought about love as a law? You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton, Alyssa Britton, and Alexander Thompson.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2022.